Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're going back into our archives now because recent events provide a rare opportunity. J.D. Vance, now the Republican nominee for vice president, first gained fame with his book Hillbilly Elegy about hard times in the Rust Belt. He visited the Jefferson Exchange in August of 2016, and here's that interview, edited for Time.
Among other things in the book, you cite, and I'm going to quote you here, a peculiar crisis of masculinity in which some of the very traits that our culture inculcates make it difficult to succeed in a changing world. Like what?
Well, what I think of as most important here is if you think about a young kid, a poor kid, honor and dignity and loyalty are really the only things you have, and so you'll fight to defend them. So when I was a kid, if someone insulted my mom or made a remark about my family, it was expected not just by my peer group, but even by my family, that I would return the insult and that I would fight if I needed to. And it's a relatively common thing for poor kids to be willing to go to great lengths to defend their honor because, frankly, that's all they have. They don't have a whole lot else to hang their hat on. The problem is that when you grow up in an environment like that, you learn conflict as a way to as a way to solve disputes and a way to resolve problems. And that's not necessarily the way you want to live your life if you're in a corporate boardroom or if, for example, you're in a 21st century marriage. It's something that you have to, in some ways, unlearn that hardwiring for conflict.
Ultimately, does life not feel right if you don't have something to fight against?
Well, I think that in some ways it doesn't feel quite right, and it's interesting how different folks in that area find something to fight against, whether it's just being really passionate about a sports team or, being really, really critical of political elites, which I think is one way this has come up in the modern election. But there's definitely an element to where I think for a lot of the folks who I grew up around, for a lot of the people in my family, conflict is just a really important part of who we are, and we in some ways relish having a noble enemy.
You certainly show us warts and much more of the cultures in which you grew up. I'm saying plural, but it's really a singular thing. But you also say, I love these people. I mean, while you're being honest about their warts, what prompted the book, J.D.?
Well, like I said, I was in law school and really concerned by the fact that I didn't see a whole lot of people like me at the law school. And, of course, this is a time, and we're now still in that time, where people were very worried about upward mobility and the decline of the American dream. And so I decided to just start asking some really tough questions, both of my country but also of my community, about why it was that there weren't more kids like me who were having an opportunity at that upwardly mobile American dream. And the answer that I came to is honestly that it was a combination of complex economic factors, but also some parts of our communities and families and neighborhoods that implicated certain parts of our whole culture. And so I decided that to be honest about those problems, I would be honest about the problems as I experienced them, but also as I had them myself. So I didn't want to write a book that was critical of other people. I wanted to write a book that was compassionate and, yes, somewhat critical about my own people, and that, of course, includes myself.
And so often it seems like it's not necessarily that people are being defeated by people other than themselves, but often by themselves.
That is sometimes true, and I think it's treacherous the way that we talk about these problems, because on the one hand, I think it's very easy to get caught up in victim blaming and to look at the poor and say, you know what, you're poor because of your own moral failings or because you've done something significantly wrong. But I do think, on the other hand, we have to be upfront and we have to be frank about what it is that poor folks don't know, what it is about their neighborhoods and communities that make it really hard for them to get ahead. And the answer is ultimately that there are a lot of things that they don't know, that there are a lot of values and a lot of attitudes that their neighborhoods and communities imbue them with that make it hard for them to succeed in the 21st century. And like I said, I think the only way to really address those problems is to be very upfront about them.
Let's get an idea of your attachments to people and place. You say that Kentucky belonged to you as in ways that Ohio didn't. How did that work out?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
Well, you said that Kentucky belonged to you that in ways that Ohio didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I meant by that is that I had a pretty chaotic upbringing in Southern Ohio. My mom struggled with addiction, and in many ways she struggled, I think, with the demons of her own violent, chaotic childhood and projected those problems onto her own children. And so, the life I had in Southern Ohio was going to and from different stepdads and boyfriends, living in a different home every 3 or 6 or 9 months, occasionally seeing mom abuse drugs. But in Kentucky, where I only went with my grandma, who I lived with some of the time, but not all of the time in Southern Ohio, in Kentucky, it was just me and my grandma and my sister. As my grandma said, there would be no men, there would be no outsiders, no strangers in my great-grandma's home. And so it just felt like it was my family and only my people, and frankly, the people that I wanted to be around the most and spend the most time with. So it was just this incredibly stable, loving place, even though at the end of the day, it was also very poor.
A stable, loving place, but certainly with a history of some fairly rambunctious behavior. It sounds like you kind of reveled in the stories of bloody encounters between family members and others.
I definitely did revel in it, and that was a lot of ways the lessons that I was taught by these stories. It's not just that we were doing crazy or violent things, I'm talking about my family here, but it's also that we were doing crazy things in the service of something, in the service of a family's honor, in the service of a sister's honor, in the service of defending our mother. And so there was this element of vigilante justice that I felt like my uncles and my cousins, they were all enforcers of this justice, and I really loved them for it. In a lot of ways, I tried to emulate them in my own life, not always to the best effect.
J.D. Vance is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy. And so you got some warnings from elders, your grandparents on both sides, about never to be the first one to throw a punch. Was there an exception to that rule, though?
Well, you were never supposed to be the first one to throw a punch, but it was very easy to get someone else to throw a punch because we took our honor and we took our duty to our family very seriously. So if you didn't want to start a fight, you could always just insult someone's mom or grandma and they would start a fight for you.
In your telling on the Kentucky side, certainly, it sounds like people generally did not get serious jail time or sometimes even go to jail at all for things that were seen as, well, justified, to use the name of the TV series about that same part of the world.
Yeah, that's definitely true, though I don't know that that would be true today. You know, a lot of these stories of family violence and family lore, they occurred in the 70s or the 60s or even before. And in a lot of ways, it was obviously a little bit more of a wild time. I doubt that folks could get away with what my uncles and my grandfather got away with back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I imagine there'd be some jail time or some consequences that would come along with it these days. And frankly, if you look at the rising incarceration rates among this group of people, it's probably the case that there's a lot that maybe folks would have gotten away from 50, 60 years ago that they're not getting away with now.
What has happened to Jackson, Kentucky since your childhood?
Well, Jackson was in some ways a really harsh place as far back as I could remember. So it was never a place of incredible opportunity. It was always a very impoverished place. I think in a lot of ways it's definitely gotten worse. Not so much in terms of poverty, because like I said, it's always been a very poor place, but in some of the social indicators that often come along with poverty. So I think folks are probably working even less than they used to, a little bit more reliant on disability and other forms of government assistance. But also the big issue is that there's been this rising opioid epidemic that's moved into places like Jackson and frankly into Southern Ohio that's caused rising mortality rates, but also just this incredible hopelessness, because it's the sort of place where you open up the newspaper and you just look for the 20, 25-year-old kids who have died, but the obituary doesn't list their cause of death because their parents are too ashamed. And we all know folks like that. We all know kids who fall into that trap. And so it's just a very sad place in a lot of ways.
That's the local news, and then occasionally the place makes national news, and not for good reasons. You mentioned that ABC News came into that part of Kentucky about 7 years ago. What was the story about?
Well, it was about Appalachian, depending on where you're from, Appalachian poverty. And the big takeaway from that series is that there are a lot of people who are really struggling, a lot of folks who, if they didn't have government assistance, could even starve to death. And a lot of kids who grow up in these very chaotic environments where it's difficult to study and difficult to really think about and plan for your future. And what was really interesting about this, you know, it was done by Diane Sawyer, who's actually from Eastern Kentucky, but it actually caused a lot of anger from people who grew up in that region of the world. You know, there were a lot of folks who said, look, this is a pretty honest look at the problems that exist in these communities. But there was, frankly, a big backlash against that documentary because people felt it unfairly maligned people as dumb, toothless hillbillies. And that conflict, that contrast between recognizing that there are very legitimate problems, but also seeing some of these criticisms as stereotyping, that has always existed in that region of the country, and it's something I try to avoid in the book. Maybe I did a good job, or maybe I didn't. I think time will tell.
J.D., you've lived in several places now, and how would you say is the perception of the American dream in Appalachia, at least the part that you knew? I mean, does it exist there at all?
A lot of people don't think that it does exist, and if you look at the statistics, they're not totally out of line in thinking that the future may not be better than the past. You know, a lot of these areas, it's not just that it's difficult to come by good jobs. It's also difficult to raise a successful family. It's difficult to raise a kid without that kid getting caught up in drugs or crime or something else. And the people there, both if you talk to them, but also if you look at some of the data, are very pessimistic about their economic future. They are quite convinced that their kids are not going to live a better life than they did. And unfortunately, it's not always true, but it is increasingly true that it's hard for folks who grew up in these areas to get ahead. There was a massive study done by a Harvard economist about 4 or 5 years ago that looked at the different regional allocation of the American dream, and he found, you know, places like Utah and places like Oregon and California, the American dream's doing pretty well, it's alive and well. But in a lot of these Rust Belt and southern areas, folks find it really, really hard for their children to have a better life than they did.
J.D. Vance, in a sense, straddles the Ohio River with a foot in Kentucky and a foot in Middletown, Ohio, a steel town. So the Rust Belt and hillbilly country, as he puts it. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. So why did you grow up in Middletown, or Middletucky, as you sometimes call it? Who took your family out of Kentucky and in search of what?
So my grandparents initially moved to Middletown because it was the land of opportunity. When they grew up in eastern Kentucky coal country, there were really two choices. One was to go down in the mines, as they said, so work in a coal mine, or the other was to not really be able to find work at all. And so my grandpa didn't want to do either of those things, and my grandma was young and pregnant. So they decided to move to southern Ohio, like a lot of other families and people, and try to find work in the industrial economy in southern Ohio. And they, of course, did. My grandpa earned a good wage for his entire life, had a good career, really loved what he did. And that really took our family, our entire family story, you know, from eastern Kentucky to southern Ohio. But, of course, it never quite left. We were always very attached to eastern Kentucky, at least I was, because I grew up with my grandparents and so spent a lot of time in their home because they still spent a lot of time there themselves.
And as you mentioned already, a fair amount of that part of Kentucky seemed to come with up the so-called Hillbilly Highway and take residence in the same area. So you had essentially a Kentucky enclave, hence the term Middletucky for Middletown. Give us a sense, though, of what people back in Kentucky thought of the people who moved away.
Well, there was definitely some stigma attached to the folks who left. We had this phrase that was often used against anyone who our family perceived had become non-humble or a little overconfident. We said, you've gotten too big for your britches. And my grandparents heard that a lot from their family back in Kentucky, that they had gotten too big for their britches, that they maybe were a little bit too disconnected from the holler and from the eastern Kentucky homeland that all of us cared about so deeply. And I think it's really sad because in a lot of ways my grandma never felt at home in southern Ohio. For the folks that were from from Kentucky, you know, she always liked those people and felt at home among them. But for the native Ohio citizens who were maybe a little more upper income, she always felt a little maligned and a little looked down upon by those folks. And so it was this weird juxtaposition where the people that she considered her family thought that she had grown too big for her britches, but the new home that she had settled into, they didn't totally accept her either.
Huh. So you like the poor relations in the new place and like the people who think they're too good for us in the old place.
Yeah, exactly.
J.D. Vance from 2016 talking about his life and his book, Hillbilly Elegy. He was not a politician then and did not think much of Donald Trump. More thoughts from that interview when we return to the JX in just a bit. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. It has never happened before that an interview guest ended up a major party nominee for president or vice president. It happened to J.D. Vance 8 years after we talked to him about his book, Hillbilly Elegy. He was not a politician then and talked easily about some moments that demonstrate his family's skills for coping with life.
Tell the story of Uncle Jimmy with Mama and Pawpaw in the pharmacy looking at toys.
Yeah, so my Uncle Jimmy was 9 or 10, and he talked about there was a toy that he really wanted, and a pharmacy had that toy. So he went in and started playing with it, and the store clerk told him, basically, put that down, stop messing with it, you're going to break it. So my Uncle Jimmy stood outside in the cold and felt a little chastised, I'm sure, as any kid would, and my grandparents happened upon him and said, you know, what happened? And he told the story, and they were just very unhappy that this store clerk dared to speak down to their little kids. So they went in there and they really ransacked the place. They started throwing everything. My grandpa actually took one of the toys that my uncle had been playing with and slammed it on the ground and broke it. And then, you know, he moved towards the store clerk in a very menacing way and actually threatened to break his neck if that clerk ever talked to his son like that again. And I think this just goes to show that they were always a little out of place in their new homes. They didn't quite know how to fit in. And, you know, and with the Christmas shopping throng, but they also, you know, they still lived there and they had to figure it out.
So outsiders could certainly not disrespect the family, but how about people within the family?
Well, you know, insiders could disrespect and could be very frank, and I think that's one of the big bright lines that exists between those who criticize Appalachia or the people who live there and those who are considered outsiders and are perceived as not allowed to criticize it. So, you know, my grandparents felt very strongly that if you were inside the Klan, you could be as open or as honest about the family's problems as you wanted to be. But if you were outside of the Klan, if you were even outside of the home, but maybe related by blood, then, you know, you weren't to be trusted and you weren't to be, you weren't to be entrusted with family secrets.
I want to let people know who are just joining us, it's Klan with a C, not Klan with a K. We're talking to J.D. Vance about his book, Hillbilly Elegy. Your mom was one of three surviving kids of Mama and Papa, born in 1961. What was the success rate in life of the three?
So my aunt and my uncle both did reasonably well. They both built successful homes, successful families, and each had successful careers in their own way that they certainly took roundabout ways getting there. But my mom was the one for whom the statistics really caught up to. They grew as good as my grandparents were to me. They did provide a very violent and chaotic home to their own children, and my mom really suffered from that, I think, for her entire life, and continues to, in some ways, suffer through it today. It's one of the interesting parts of writing the book that I've actually learned that my mom is really a sympathetic figure. And even though she struggled, I think, to make good decisions in her own life, I think I understand why she struggled, knowing a little bit about her own background. But, you know, she was never quite able to hold down a great job, never able to build a successful marriage. She's been married 5 times. And you know, towards the past 10 or 15 years has really struggled with drug addiction that's so common in these areas. So in a lot of ways, you know, Mom, like I said, is the kid who lost the game of statistics.
You know, one of the things, obviously, that made this book what it is the fact that you managed to get out of Middletown. You ended up at Yale Law and have made a career for yourself in investments in Silicon Valley now. As you were growing up, though, I mean, it was still Armco Steel back then. It's AK Steel now, still open but smaller. What was your wish or belief about your ever working there?
Oh, I had no idea that I'd be doing, you know, anything like I'm doing now. And, you know, I figured, like most kids, that I probably didn't want to work at Armco because, you know, my grandparents were very insistent that I should go to college and get some sort of job. I always figured that I'd be able to. I think no kid thinks that steel mill work is glorious, and that's not something they really aspire to when they're 11 or 12 years old. But the flip side is that I always assumed it would be there if I needed it. And, of course, for a lot of kids, it's not.
You say, you write to the average Middletonian, hard work doesn't matter as much as raw talent.
Yeah, there's definitely a perception that hard work matters a whole lot less than raw talent. When I got into Yale Law School, so many people congratulated me basically for being some sort of genius or being super smart. And as I write in the book, that's just not true. I think I got a little bit lucky, and I think I worked pretty hard. But the idea that folks who are at places like Yale or Harvard are just extraordinarily brilliant, no, they're pretty smart, they're pretty lucky, and they work hard. And that's I think true of most of the American elite. But I think that it goes to show how disconnected people are from places like Harvard and Yale, from Washington, D.C., because they don't see anybody from their town making it. They don't see that it's possible to go to a great college or to have a great career. And so they start to, I think, assume things about the people who do make it that in many cases just aren't true.
Well, and the people, the assumptions that are made from the folks who were essentially stuck back in places like Middletown. I mean, I want to be careful and not label a whole bunch of people lazy, but you do get in some pages here about your observations about the men in that culture.
Yeah, and I don't think it's primarily about laziness as much as I think it's about people not believing that their choices matter. So there's this concept called learned helplessness, which is effectively after you've been beaten down so much, after you've seen so few things work out in your favor, you stop believing that you actually have agency over your own life. You start to think, well, I can try, but it's not going to matter, so I'm not going to try. And there are a lot of people who grew up in these areas, a lot of kids who take this message to heart, who just don't see any connection between their hard work and their achievements and any sort of material success. And so, again, it breeds this sense of hopelessness and frustration that no matter how hard I work, no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to get ahead. I think it's important to note, and one of the things I try to be very explicit about in the book, is that I don't think that attitude is totally right. I do think that we have to recognize that poor folks in America face unique barriers, but we also have to give them a message that they can control their own destiny. And that was something that my grandma really, really fought against in me, was that perception that the deck was stacked against me. She knew life wasn't fair, but she also made sure that I believed that I had some control over my own life, because without that, I wouldn't have had the incentive to make better choices.
Well, you know, and a lot of things could have gone wrong for you. You pointed out how much trouble your mother had holding decent jobs and holding on to relationships. A lot of churn of father figures in your life growing up. How much of a rock then were those grandparents in Middletown?
Oh, they were the most important things in my life, absolutely. They were the things that gave me stability, that gave me comfort, that made sure I had access to meals and to school clothes when I really needed them. We talk about the safety net in this country, and for a lot of folks, the only safety net, of course, they have is some sort of assistance from the state or from the federal government. But for me, the biggest safety net in my life was Mamaw and Papaw, because they really gave me all the things that I didn't have and made sure that I had a chance and made sure that I had a good life when other things in my world were falling through.
What were their views on education? How much did they help, for example, with schoolwork?
Yeah, they thought education was really important. They never let me forget that I was blessed to have an education. I think that's an attitude that it's really easy to forget when you grow up in a country as wealthy as ours. But for them, you know, they grew up in a one-room school shack. My grandma didn't graduate from high school. And so they really made sure that I believed that I was lucky to get an education. And even when I didn't quite believe it, they just, you know, they would be mean about it if they had to and made sure I did my schoolwork. My grandpa loved to practice math problems with me because he thought it was important that I learn, you know, math ahead of the rest of my class. And in a lot of different ways, they gave me this subtle signal that education mattered and that I needed to take things of the mind, pursuits of the mind, very seriously because they didn't have the opportunity to do so themselves.
And that really stuck. I mean, and certainly there was enough turmoil around you with, for example, when your mom and third husband moved you guys away from Middletown, and that got ugly. And then you mentioned that answering questions about brothers and sisters got complicated because of all the half and step siblings. Was there a turning point at which your formative years reached relative stability, J.D.?
There definitely was. You know, when I was, there were a couple turning points. So when I was 12 years old, my grandma basically set a family rule that I was allowed to live with her whenever I wanted to. And that always gave me a sort of backstop, a safety valve. So if things ever got too chaotic at my own home, I was always able to go and spend some time with her and make things, you know, easy that way. And then the second turning point was when I was 14, or I think 15 actually, and my grandma took that choice to go and live with her to a demand that I live with her permanently and constantly. And that was actually that was actually set in motion because my mom had demanded a jar of clean urine because she needed to pass a urine test, and she didn't have clean urine herself, so she came to Mamaw's house when I was staying there one night and said, the next morning, look, you've got to give me this jar of urine, or I'm going to fail this test. And I think then Mamaw realized that what was happening in the world around me was really starting to take its toll. I almost failed out of high school my freshman year when this happened, and she finally said, look, this has got to stop. You're going to come and stay with me, not every couple times per week, but you're going to come and stay with me permanently, and that's not going to change until you graduate from high school.
Wow. So you really laid the line down and said, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
As things turned around and as you got better in high school and went to the Marines, went to Ohio State, went to Yale Law, it seems like your eye for detail, though, it must have developed before you left for the Marines. I'm thinking that started when you're still in Middletown.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I definitely have always had an observer's eye, and I've always considered the things around me and tried to keep track of them. So I definitely think, obviously, it served me well as I wrote the book, that there were a lot of little details that I remembered, or a lot of little things that I saved, actually. You know, there were memories that had completely fallen away, but were, you know, were kind of jiggered because I actually remembered that I had a note, or I had a card, or I had an old photograph that a lot of people might have thrown away.
All right. So you clearly resist the idea that life is worse for working class whites purely because of economics. And there's a phrase that really stands out from early in the book. You write about a culture that increasingly encourages social decay instead of counteracting it. How does it encourage social decay?
Well, it encourages social decay by some of the things I talked about earlier, that it encourages kids to think that they don't have much of an opportunity, that they don't have much hope, that the future and the deck is stacked against them. It encourages decay by exposing them to environments that make it very hard for them to have successful families themselves, right? So it's not just that my mom was some sort of villain. It's that she actually learned family chaos and instability from her own parents. And then she applied that lesson to her own children. And of course, if we weren't lucky, if we didn't have my grandparents kind of getting their act together, I think my sister and I would have then applied that lesson to our children. And it's just impossible to do well in school and to have much of a successful life when you fear the school bell at the end of the day, when you don't want to go home. So that's one way. That's another way it encourages that social decay. I think it encourages that social decay by pointing the finger sometimes at folks who have wronged us without asking us to think about the ways that we could make our own lot better. And so, you know, you take these things together, and it's not always the case that it's easy for us to get ahead. And sometimes that's because of external factors, but sometimes it's because of the things that we're doing and saying to ourselves.
There's lots of praise for Hillbilly Elegy, especially because of the passions of working class whites in this election. I mean, what do you make of that phenomenon and people connecting your book to it?
Well, it's interesting. I of course, didn't write a political book. It's obviously true that a lot of the people that I write about are ultimately the base of the Donald Trump movement, and are the sort of folks who are so frustrated with the elites and with the political and financial class that they're willing to support Donald Trump. So I think in some ways it's natural to draw the inference between my book and the political moment because of just how these blue-collar white voters have been such a big part of the election. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that these voters are still going to be around long after Donald Trump fades. They're still going to be frustrated in a lot of ways. They're still going to have significant social problems. And so I hope that this starts a conversation that doesn't just finish after Trump loses, which I think he will lose. I hope that it continues long into the next 4, 5, 10 years, because these voters and these people really do, I think, need help, and we ought to think constructively about how to help them.
Which J.D. Vance has turned his full attention to, first as U.S. Senator, now as Republican nominee for Vice President. Obviously, his rejection of Trump has done a complete U-turn. The interview is from 2016, now a time capsule of a major political figure's development. That's it for today's Exchange. Catch us online at jeffexchange.org. Angela Decker's our senior producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.